Waigijika Khalsa, Waigijiki Fateh. Welcome to another episode of Ask Canadian Six. I am your host, Jess Bufora, and we are joined by Harman Kondola from Edmonton. Harman, you know our friends from China and India are listening to our podcast. Are you doing anything you want to say to them?
Keep trying, and we're going to keep winning elections.
All right, so today we're going to talk about obviously we're going to talk about election interference. We're going to talk about a brand new report that World Sikh Organization and the National Canadian Council of Muslims released together, which is very exciting. I'm very impressed by this report. We'll talk about the reaction to the report, and then we'll talk about some interesting work that's been going on in Seattle and currently in Toronto around anti-caste and anti-caste motions and laws. So to start with, the World Sikh Organization released a report called the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS, Network in Canada, in collaboration with the National Canadian Council of Muslims. And it outlines, if you are not familiar, I mean, I'm going to try and explain this, but honestly, if these are new terms, or if you've heard of the RSS, but you're not exactly sure what it means, that's what this report is for. It's a 60-page report. It's really easy to read and understand. And if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already someone that is keen on politics, is keen on understanding how people and systems of power work. So read it. But generally, the gist of it is that the RSS is a non-government group. It's a very influential group. It's the main group behind the BJP, which is the leading party in India right now. It's a Hindu supremacist group trying to create a Hindu India. And it results in a lot of violence and oppression towards lower caste folks, Sikhs, Muslims, Christians. And it has an intricate network of partners, and it's like a family. So there's HSS, there's branches that work out of public schools in Canada. It's very elaborate. And before this report, I haven't actually seen that elaborate mechanism explained in such a good way. So that's what the RSS is, and that's kind of what the report does. It dives into how they operate in Canada. Harman, do you have a chance to take a look at the report? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's groundbreaking in the sense that it's also a collaboration between NCCM, you know, the prominent and preeminent Muslim advocacy organization in Canada, partnering with the WSO, put out is extremely necessary information about the operation and an, you know, kind of expose of how deep the tentacles of the RSS are in Canada today. You know, when you listen to the experience of people who grew up in India, you know, and their experience with the RSS, the RSS sometimes will work at the ground level in a way that may seem innocent. So a lot of people will tell you about when they were young in their local mahalla, there would be people who were doing morning yoga classes or morning, you know, kind of parade or and, you know, they would get out there and they'd be chanting. And they never understood, and their parents never understood, that this was actually, you know, an organization that was modeled on the Hitler Youth and drew massive inspiration from, you know, the Third Reich and from the Nazis and from Hitler in how they organized and how they looked at the world in terms of, you know, kind of from a supremacist perspective. It's so troubling when you look at this and you actually read about the founders of the RSS. And here, when they're operating here in Canada, again, on the face of it, when they're operating in these schools, you know, they're doing yoga and it seems innocent enough. Except, you know, you look at the tables and you see that they've got photos of the founders of the RSS. You know, they're promoting that ideology, and there's so much more sinister behind that that is lost, and that context is lost if you don't understand it.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
And I think that is the key message you finally get to see and confront. I mean, we can talk about the response that came out from the HSS, which is their arm here in Canada. But it's clear that Canadians do not understand that there is a Hindu supremacist organization that is actively recruiting and promoting a virulent, you know, ideology in this country, you know, carte blanche.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that, so generally when we're out there and we're doing like WSO work, Know Your Rights work, I root it in strength. I always talk about what Sikhs are. I don't talk about what we're not. I haven't historically in my WSO work talked about Hindu supremacy, which is why I think this is kind of new. We understand how it works. I learned a lot from this report. I didn't fully understand the mechanisms of it. But I never really made it a part of my presentations. So I did have a recent experience where I was doing an informational session on behalf of the WSO. And I think in anti-oppressive work, where I have seen it grow over the past few years, in school boards and educational settings, when we go out and do workshops and seminars, we have slowly built up to a place where we can use terms like white supremacy, white fragility, white guilt. And we will have folks in the room, including white folks in the room, understand, and maybe it feels uncomfortable and maybe it feels defensive, but I have seen folks work through those feelings. And now we use those terms. I hear those terms. I hear anti-Black racism as a term. I hear anti-Indigenous racism as a term. And that's credit to all of the folks and activists who made sure that those things were well-defined. None of those were well-received when they first came into the vernacular, but now they are terms that can be used in seminars and workshops. They're part of my mandatory work trainings. Like, these things come up. We don't have a vocabulary around the RSS. We don't have the term like Hindutva or Hindu supremacy is not established. So actually, someone, at the request of the person who asked for the training, I explained this. I explained what Hindu supremacy was, and it was not well received. And it was, there was a lot of guilt. There was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of feelings in the room. And I think that it occurred to me that, like, we don't even have the groundwork for the conversation. We don't have the vocabulary for this conversation. And when I said, like, some of the things you said, Harmon, like when I said it's Nazi inspired, or they're like Nazi, like the clothing they wear is like Nazis, or that they, their rhetoric is Nazi inspired. One of the pieces of feedback I got was, you're comparing apples and oranges, or you're adding a value judgment to someone's religion. So this is one of the things that I think is really important. We're not talking about Hindus. We're talking about Hindu supremacy. We're talking about a very small margin of people who are supremacists, in the same way that we would never convolute the KKK with Christians. But the fundamental idea that these folks think that they are supreme in who they are, and that they should have the rule of the land, for this obscure group, it's really important that we have the vocabulary to name who they are. And it's really important to know the facts, like they are Nazi inspired. And that's not a metaphor. That's not a simile. That's not a judgment. I'm going to pull something from the report. And this is why, if you don't understand, if you're listening and you're like, oh, I didn't know that, then it's important to read this report as well. So this is on page 2 of the report. So this exclusionary vision is grounded in ideological frameworks propagated by founding RSS figures such as Keshav Baliram Hegdewar, Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, and Madhuvaro, I'm sorry, I'm butchering these names, Sadavaro Goalkar. And then they share some quotes from those dudes. So one, Savarkar says, "We Hindus in India grow stronger. In time, these Muslim friends of the League will have to play the part of German to Jews. And then Golgar says, to keep the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here. Germany has also shown how well nigh impossible it is for races and cultures having differences going to root to be assimilated to one united whole, a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by. So these are the folks who inspired the RSS. These are the folks that inspired the movement. These are the ideologies that inspired the movement. And it goes, and you can even see like RSS, like all the ways that it works in Canada. If you actually go to later on in the report, it literally lists a bunch of schools in the Toronto District School Board, in the Peel District School Board. So throughout the Greater Toronto area, there are chapters of the Chukas of the HSS who list those school public school addresses as their home address. So on one hand, we'll talk about the anti-caste motion in a second. But in one hand, we're getting this feedback that says, no, this isn't happening. There's no caste oppression in our schools. That's not a real thing. And on the other hand, those same schools, so the Toronto District School Board is being told there's no such thing as caste oppression in the Toronto District School Board. That same school board is the literal home of the HSS Chukas, so these sections of the RSS. And that to me is like, it blows my mind. So when we're doing lobbying work, when we're connecting with school board trustees, when we're connecting with school directors, when we're trying to do the kind of advocacy work we do, the gaslighting is so intense because you'll be told, yeah, no, that's not even a real thing. Why are you working on it? And then things like this report expose those addresses. So yeah, that was a bit of a rant, but that's where I'm at with this, just blown away. And I think the level of detail is incredible.
No, absolutely. And you know, I think the one nice thing was that there was some mainstream media coverage of the story, you know, that kind of came out of this and out of the report and really brought this issue forward, because Canada has to look at this as a threat to a lot of the principles that it stands for as a country. And until we do look at that, you know, allowing the RSS to kind of run rampant is problematic. I mean, the RSS, as you've so well summarized, is arguably one of the most influential organizations in the world. And remember, this is an organization that's been banned in India 3 different times. You know, the pushback that we got from the HSS was that, oh, this was outdated sources. And the response even from mainstream media journalists was, except all these are current sources and you're not actually providing us any evidence to suggest.
Yeah. So they said these are outdated resources. And when they, in the same tweet that when the reporter said that, she said the report had 138 academic and journalistic resources.
Just no credibility to the pushback. Nothing to argue against anything that was contained in the report. And so it stands. I mean, even if you go further, the nice part is that now there is this recognition that there are actors in this country who are pushing a Hindutva agenda. You know, MP Chandra Arya of the Liberals, who we've talked about before, he raised an RSS flag on Parliament. And up until now, a lot of people didn't have context of, well, what was the RSS and why should that even matter as a story. So now, you know, there is that support that is well researched to demonstrate why that is so problematic. And I think people need to understand that the erosion of democracy that you see in India is deeply concerning. This is something that, as the G20 was starting in India and being set to host, needs to be on the agenda for the Canadian government to raise. You know, I know the government is interested in looking at you know, further trade relationships, but without an acknowledgement of the erosion of democracy, the rise of this virulent, you know, kind of casteist, you know, radical organization, the RSS, because people need to understand, RSS transcends just politics. In India, the RSS has infiltrated the judiciary. It's infiltrated other state institutions like the police. And that is the real power that RSS wields in that country. The BJP is just one simple outlet for a lot of the work. So this is an organization that their members, it is literally one of the largest member organizations in the world. And it has it's not a fringe ideology that exists there, right? Like, it is radical, it is problematic, there's so many things to describe it. But it's the state ideology of India today. And yet that's not being recognized by Canadian government when it's dealing with Modi and the BJP.
And I think here's where I land with this. I think the part of me that is activist and does human rights work is like, I want to scream it from the rooftops at the level of this report. I am impressed with this report. I'm proud of this report. I think it's one of the finer pieces of work that WSO has done. It's right out there with our education guide, healthcare guide, like high quality stuff. Huge shout outs to NCCM for doing the heavy lifting on this. Really great. The part of me that's an educator is thinking like, slow down. People need to build the vocabulary. And I think if that's something that can come out of this, that is a huge, huge, huge step. If you go into situations and you start talking with the RSS and folks are not ready to hear it, it's going to be met with resistance. It's going to be met with gaslighting. That doesn't happen here. That's not a real thing. You don't know what you're talking about. And I think if I look at the work that other marginalized communities have done, and the way they've used education as a tool, and the way they have labored for so long to make sure that people are there, able to have that conversation. And now we can talk about white supremacy in a work training, and everyone kind of understands what that means. That approach of mine, it's like, when I think about that, I think, here's what we all need to do. We all need to start looking at religion as a social location. So when we talk about, like, I understand my gender, and I understand if have privilege in that gender, or we say, I understand that I'm able-bodied and maybe I have privilege in that, or we've been able to name these other places where we either experience privilege or oppression, straight up, we need to add religion to that. We need to be able to say in everyone, every time we do one of those trainings, we're like, I'm this and I'm that and I'm that and I'm that. We need to be able to say, this is my religion. And what does that mean? Am I in a position of privilege? Am I in a position of being oppressed? Does that change based on what country I'm in? What does it mean that Hindus are a minority in Canada, but a majority in India? That when folks don't have an understanding of someone being from a religious majority because they are not a religious majority in their country, what does that mean? So can I name my own religion? Can I name my relationship to power and privilege based on my religion? Can I invite other people in the room to do the same? And once we have that level of self-reflection and we start to understand the connection between religion and social location, then can we start to build this vocabulary around religious supremacy? Do we use things as proxies? Like, if we can understand Christian supremacy because we live on colonized land and there was genocide of Indigenous people on this land and we know the Catholic Church was involved, is that one maybe a little bit easier for us to understand? And then once we understand that, can we understand how that could be reproduced in other countries where other religions were majorities? And so that's kind of where I'm at. Where, like, one side I'm like, yeah, let's totally get out there and let's totally make sure everyone understands this. And the other part of me realizes this is deep personal work. And if we push it too quickly, it's going to be met with resistance. And we're going to keep getting that feedback like, oh, this isn't real. This is not happening here. Meanwhile, it's literally, I could give you the exact address where it's happening. So read the report. That's my plug. If you read it and you learn anything from it, my second ask is please share it. Please share it. Please make it a part of your work, make it a part of your networks. So related to that, because I think the timing of this report was really interesting. It was right between after the Seattle anti-caste motion was passed, and then the Toronto District School Board is now contemplating a motion that would, it's an anti-caste motion as well. I think the reason the timing is interesting is because the report makes a direct connection between this supremacist ideology and the oppression of caste. And these conversations are saying, oh, that doesn't act, the people who are resisting these are saying that doesn't really happen. That doesn't happen here. You're racist for saying that there's caste-based oppression in Toronto. It's racist for you to try and bring us down. So yeah, Harmon, you've been following this. You've been following what was going in Seattle, what's going on here in Toronto. What's your take on this? What are you, do you think that anti-caste motions and bills are necessary? What's a sick Canadian take on this? Where do you see this conversation going?
Well, I think caste-based discrimination is one of the most vile forms of oppression that exist on the face of the earth. As Sikhs, it is our duty to be allies to so many Dalits and caste-oppressed people. You know, you have Dalit activists who have brought forward the motions in Seattle and now at the Toronto School Board. It is absolutely necessary to have enshrined in you know, human rights law across this country and across jurisdictions, to have protections for those who are being discriminated based on caste grounds. You know, this is something that came to the forefront in the mainstream media a few years ago with a lot of the caste-based discrimination you were seeing in Silicon Valley, in the tech world. You know, there a lot of this hate and oppression was being seen in big tech companies where, you know, I think it was an affront to so much of the culture in the tech industry. But a lot of people who continue to maintain that those types of views and target Dalits and caste oppressed people. So no surprise when you see opposition to what, frankly, to any individual right-thinking human would think that this is just makes sense. It's logical. But again, you see a lot of people who have shown up to oppose, and they're organized, and they're trying to organize. And today we saw the expose of their organizing techniques, and the ability for them to kind of rationalize this as some type of threat to their children's future and civilization being threatened. We're here to protect vulnerable communities. We're here to protect people who are being oppressed. It's frankly mind-boggling that there's organizations that are active on the ground in Canada that are opposing caste oppression.
Yeah, so it's 2023. People are coming out openly pro-caste, right? Like, they're writing to the Toronto District School Board, which we call the TDSB. They are organizing protests, and this, what Harmon talked about, if you follow Buzz News on Twitter, you'll see there's screenshots of their organizing group. So we can see the mechanisms of them. There's like a 14-point list on how to organize. And there are instructions on that list like, don't laugh. You're not here to have fun. Don't say any Hindu slogans. And they give examples like, don't say anything religious. If anyone asks, you're South Asian. If you can bring a visibly identifying Sikh friend, that's good for us. And dress weather appropriate. here's a list of things that you're going to say word for word if you're approached by the media. And it's actually really, you get to see into how they organize and how they're coming out openly pro-caste oppression. And one of the interesting things, so it's screenshots of the group chat where they're organizing. You see in there, someone says, let's take these, they're talking about the people who are supporting the anti-caste motion in the TDSB. So that would be folks like WSO who are asking the TDSB to vote yes on this anti-caste motion to ban caste-based oppression in their schools. And there's all of these action items linked to that. So in this group chat, that these organizers are putting together, they say, let's gather their names and let's give them to the consulates. Some of them have overseas citizenship of India. Let's have their citizenship revoked. They're essentially admitting in their group chat that the Indian consulate in Toronto does the bidding of Hindu supremacists and will weaponize things like the right to have citizenship in India to make sure that they put people in their place. That's how pro-caste they are. They will take away, they will get the consulate to take away your overseas citizenship of India. Like, it's actually the kind of thing where you're like, not only are you a criminal, but you're a bad criminal. Like, who puts that in writing? And obviously someone in your group chat is doing screenshots and sending them around. So, just really difficult to see. The response has been, if it's not for the faint of heart. And again, I keep using the term gaslighting because they keep coming back and saying like, this just isn't happening. This isn't, caste-based oppression doesn't happen. This isn't, you're actually racist against South Asians because you're making us look like we're divided. It's a very small group of people, but they've managed to get like thousands of bots and trolls to sign a petition online. They make themselves look a lot bigger than they are. It's actually really funny, when they did their in-person protest, there was like 15 of them holding paper signs on the street. So you can see it's just a core group of people that are producing most of the content around this. But this is the kind of thing where if you, again, if it speaks to you, you can definitely get involved in very real ways. All right. So last thing we'll touch on is election interference. It's been an interesting few days. We know that there's been some, and it's not anything that the government has willingly, information they've willingly volunteered. It always seems like it's a little bit of pulling teeth, but after some of that going through and getting that information to come forward, we now know that China was very invested in our last federal election and there was foreign interference. What do you think, Carmen, when you see these stories coming out about China and foreign interference, and what's the connection there for the kind of foreign interference stuff we're always trying to put on the radar?
There's clear evidence that exists on the ground of the government of India's role to distort our democracy. People in politics understand the influence that the consulate here tries to exert over elected officials when it comes to policy and when it comes to what happens with our democracy. It's no surprise, last election, the conservatives feel that there were certain races where their election races where they were manipulated by social media pressure, by pressure on the ground to influence the outcomes. In their report post-election, they documented, 12 ridings where they felt that this existed. The sad part is that this was not looked at when it comes to the lens of the Indian government. And that's the tragedy that we have, where a lot of our mainstream parties perhaps are not looking in the right direction, or looking broad enough or further enough, when there has been reports of the government of India doing the same. You know, recently we saw the nomination of a very problematic character who has echoed pro-India speaking talking points consistently, anti-Sikh, political narratives, recently being nominated as a Conservative Party of Canada candidate in the next election. So it gives the community a lot of alarm that this issue is not being taken more seriously. I absolutely think that, the government needs to look into this in a much more serious way and listen to the agencies that it has, and listen to community, because ultimately Ask Canadian Six, the movement, was to help inform, what our perspective is. And there is enough out there to suggest that India is trying to distort our democracy.
And this is the thing with paying attention to Iran or Russia or China and not offering that same gaze to India. I'm confident that someone is looking at it in the same way that someone was looking at China. We just don't get to find out as citizens until something like this upcoming probe now. So there's going to be a launch. They've launched a probe into China's election meddling. Until something like that comes, because there's a dollar and there's a demand for it, we don't ever actually get to find out. So here's to hoping that someone's actually got their eyes on India. But the other thing is that we, and also specifically sick Canadian sick politicians, constantly get accused of doing Khalistan bidding, of doing so. We'll get that from folks who are pro India, but even from like low key racism from white supremacists who will say like, oh, you know, you're still hung up on the issues from your country. Look at all the stuff that Jagmeet got about standing up for Sikh issues. We've had Navdeep Bains been accused of being a Khalistani. We Terry Malowski in every breath will try and connect someone who's a Sikh politician to being a Khalistani. No Canadian Sikh politician has openly lobbied for Khalistan. They have the right to. It's peaceful discourse. Like, it wouldn't. I would actually be impressed if they did, but it's not there, and it's something that they're being accused of. Meanwhile, the Indian foreign interference and the Indian puppeted Canadian politicians exist, but there's no gaze towards that. So we get this gaze from both Hindu supremacy and white supremacy, accusing us of doing things we're not doing, which even if we were doing, wouldn't be bad. And the folks who are actually doing are the puppets of foreign interference, are not getting that same critical gaze. And that's really frustrating to be able to see those things play out and to not actually be able to do anything about it. So I guess I don't know if you have any. Let's wrap with this. Do you have any predictions about, do you see a election coming up anytime soon? If there is, I mean, I know everyone's got their own theories about how long this Liberal government is going to last, and if we're headed back to the elections anytime soon. But we might get a chance to test out our theories about foreign interference and see how the Canadian government handles it in an upcoming election. But yeah, let's leave it with that. What are your theories? How much longer do you think this Liberal minority government is going to last?
Every prediction I've made about politics has always been wrong.
Okay, let's preface with that.
I'm
Yeah.
going to start being right. I think this will stretch out the full 4 years as a term. The NDP has very little incentive to pull out of this. They'd be decimated if there was an election. So the Liberals definitely have a very willing partner to keep the coalition going. And there's a very real threat that the Conservatives will potentially be able to make a breakthrough and form government. So I think we'll see the full 4 go. But Alberta's exciting times. We're a few months away from an election here. May is going to be a provincial election, and polling's got both the NDP and the UCP neck to neck. Big shout out to Amarpreet Singh, Sabka Pradhan at Dashmesh Gordon in Calgary. He won his nomination. There's another good Singh who's running for the NDP down there, Parmeet Singh. So shout out to both of them.
All right, you heard it here first. Harman says that federally that they're going to go the full length, and provincially we're going to keep an eye on you guys and make sure that we'll make sure there's no foreign interference over there, and that there's only good positive media and proper political discourse. Thank you folks so much for tuning in. Again, if anything that you heard spoke to you or the around the work that WSO does, please consider becoming a donor, either one time or a regular donor through the SWUN program. We're on every major social media platform at worldsick.org, and you can follow us so you can see all of the work that we're doing in real time. And we will catch you again. Stay tuned, because there's going to be an interview after this. So our podcast now has a new format where the second half of the podcast is going to have an interview. So you're going to get to spend some time doing some deep dives and getting to know some amazing people doing some amazing work in Canada and in other places internationally as well. So stay tuned for that interview. And Harman and I will catch you next time. Waheguru ji ka khalsa.
Waheguru
Waheguru ji ki fateh.
Vaheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Vaheguru Ji Ki Fateh. My name is Mehakleen Gore. Today I am with Jindi Singh from Khalsa's Aid, the National Director. Welcome, Jindi. Thank you for being here with us.
How are you doing today? Vaheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Vaheguru Ji Ki Fateh. I'm doing good. It's a little bit early out here on the West Coast, but I'm doing good.
Yeah, it is. I can't say it's as early here. I am in Manitoba. I can't say it's as early, but you know, it's a Sunday, so a little bit of a slower start to the day. Well, thank you for joining with me today to have a conversation on the podcast. We are very excited to have you, especially to discuss the work that's being done in Turkey at the moment on grounds. I'm aware that you are very involved in Canada with the communication that goes in and out of Turkey. So let's just jump right into it. And I guess the first place I'd like to ask you a question is, when did you get involved with Khalsa Aid, and what would you say your involvement capacity looks like?
So I was one of the founding members. So I'm originally from the UK. Same kind of hometown as Ravi Bhaji, and we were already kind of doing Seva for a few years prior to Khalsa Aid. But then when the kind of the war was happening over in kind of Kosovo, we decided that, you know, especially it was around 1999, so we, you know, celebrating 300 years of the Khalsa, we felt, you know we should take the concept of the Khalsa, go beyond, you know, the Nagar Kirtans and everything else that was happening, the great kind of celebrations for the 300 years, and kind of put it into action. So that's why we had a convoy go to Albania and help the Kosovo refugees who were pouring into there. And essentially, that's kind of where Khalsa Aid started from. Obviously, Ravi Bhaji's, you know, the kind of, it was his vision, and he's spearheaded this, you know, ever since. But I was a founding member there. I moved to Canada in 2001, carried on doing the Seva with Khalsa Aid probably till about 2004, 2005, and then stepped back a little bit just to help Canada's birth rate by, you know, having children, and then kind of stepped back in again around 2016. I've still been in contact. I know Ravi Bhaji and his family, and, you know, so we've had a relationship from before Khalsa Aid. So we started the chapters here in Canada. What we did, because of the you know, geographical size of Canada, you know, the desire really was to have as many chapters as possible across the country, not just, you know, in the kind of more urban areas. So, you know, we do have ones in GTA, Lower Mainland in Vancouver, but then also all the way from Vancouver Island, where I am, mm-hmm. all the way across to Halifax, you know, and in some of the northern parts of the country as well. So we have chapters in Sudbury, Ontario, and a couple of other places as well.
Okay, wow. So kind of all over, which is amazing. That is awesome. And in Manitoba, where I'm from as well, we do have a Khalsa Aid chapter here as well. And I am in communication with some of the folks who are involved. And it's always amazing to sit down and have that conversation about what Khalsa Aid is doing. Just within Manitoba, I'm always so amazed. So to know of all the work being done globally is so heartwarming, and so it kind of gives you that little hope. So thank you for being one of the founders of such an amazing organization.
Thank you.
So if we were to discuss what is the work that is being done specifically in Turkey right now, so what kind of relief is Khalsa Aid specifically doing in Turkey at the moment?
So after the earthquake happened, within about 24 hours or so, our team in Iraq, so we in Kurdistan, kind of controlled Iraq, we have a team there that's been established there for a number of years. So they crossed over with several thousand blankets, and we started distributing those almost immediately. And then within another day or two, we're doing meals. The first week or two is always like this. It's a little bit scattered in the sense of you're just providing emergency relief immediately because people have become unhoused, you know, or they don't want to go back into their homes because they're fearful of from the aftershocks mm-hmm. that were happening the first week or two. And in some cases, like in the villages, the government had advised people do not go into your homes, you know, live outside in tents and so on. So because of the weather, you know, and the coldness, the need for blankets and hot meals was immediate. And that's what's happened in the first week or two. Now what's happening is we're beginning to engage with a lot more other charities. From the beginning, we were working with the Bazani Charity Foundation, BCF, but now we're kind of reaching out and working with a number of other kind of smaller groups as well. And now it's just a case of continuing the survey, doing our assessments, trying to determine exactly what is needed. What often happens is people assume they know what's needed and they go bring a mountain of, say, clothing, and then realize nobody needs clothing, right? So it's very important to do assessments and figure out what's happening. I think a lot of people online, they see the social media, they see us giving things out, you know, and sometimes even our detractors will say, you know, oh, the langarichal on there. Mm-hmm. They don't realize how difficult it is in the first week, you know, getting access to fuel and fresh water was very difficult. You cannot run a langar without fresh water, right? and you know, propane tanks or other forms of fuel. So that took a while to kind of obtain and set up kitchens. And now the kind of things have settled a bit. There's still issues, like, for example, today in San Leofo, which is where kind of where our team is kind of centered, a nearby building collapsed. So a lot of the buildings are still very weak. There was no earthquake, but, you know, they eventually crumble just because there are structural issues, which no one can see from the outside, but it can happen. So there's always that risk there.
Right. Yeah. I guess the aftermath is not always as reported in media as much as the significant moments such as earthquakes. So when you're not on ground, you're not, I guess, like even for myself, I wasn't aware of this, the buildings that, which it does make sense, they are falling, but it's not, you know, on, since it's not being on a big earthquake or something, it's not being recorded, it's not as actively on my mind. So that is it, yeah, of course, it requires a lot of power, human power, to run this seva. And so in terms of volunteers that you folks have, are they, now you mentioned that they originally had come from close by, but do you have global volunteers that are coming in from, say Canada or say America? And how many volunteers do you think you have on ground at the moment?
Well, on the ground right now, the kind of core team, there's about 10 members, but then we also have about 20, 30 other people we're working closely with. And they're, like I said, you know, people with BCF. There's ICRA, which is another charity. Kizile Turkey is another charity, and a handful of others as well, who we're working closely with. Initially, like I said, the Iraq team had crossed over because they were the nearest. But then soon after, within days, we had teams from the UK go over. Mm-hmm. We did send two volunteers from Canada, one from Winnipeg and one from Halifax. Mm-hmm. And they were there on the ground for about 5 days, I believe, and then they've returned now. And they helped a lot with the hot meal program. And we're going to be sending another one, actually from Winnipeg again, I think next weekend. So there are a lot of volunteers. Most of the volunteers right now they're from Iraq, from the US, and from the UK as well.
That is that's amazing to see that the globe is coming together to support where we can. And in terms of,
yep, I should mention as well, right in the beginning, we also had with about a couple of days or a week, we also had our head of India operations come out as well. And his experience with what he's been doing in India helped a lot on the ground.
That's amazing. Yeah, that must have been very a helpful experience, but also an eye-opening experience for everyone on ground to get that firsthand on person experience of seeing what is happening and not just through social media or through the news. I'm sure it's a very, very different experience when you are actually there. And I'm sure that's also very mentally and physically exhausting to be in that pressure and to be in an environment where it feels like you never know what's actually going to happen next. So how do you think, and if you've had communication, which I'm sure you have, with the individuals coming back and forth and staying on ground. What are they doing to keep themselves in good spirits, in that Jardikala spirit of just of positivity?
Yeah. So, I mean, first that we do get, you know, when these kind of major crises happen, we do get a lot of people just emailing and texting us and wanting to go out. And it's difficult to say no, but we have to say no. So we usually only send people who've been working with us locally in our, you know, whether it's the US, UK or Canada, for example, who've been with us for several years doing the local food bank drives, if there's been any crises here, like we had in BC with the floods. So it's people who understand Khalsa Aid, understand how we run our operations, who've been in the thick of it with us, and they're typically the ones we'll send out. So they've already had several years of kind of, you know, training with respect to the seva they've been doing. Mm-hmm. And so we know they'll be a little bit more level-headed when they go over there. Because like you said, what you see in social media is always very different from what's happening on the ground. There's a lot of, sometimes there's periods where you're doing nothing because you're waiting for someone to turn up, you know, to load up a truck, or you're being rushed by, you know, people who are displaced and, you know, everyone's trying to grab a blanket. So yeah, you have to know how to organize the deliveries and the seva you're doing. And that requires a certain amount of seniority with respect to your experience. Now on the ground, mentally, you know, people have their ups and downs. They're all together. We try to ensure that they will stay together. And, you know, go out for a meal afterwards together, whether it's, you know, sitting by a tent or finding a local restaurant to eat and allowing people to discuss things. You know, as an example, when I send volunteers out, I'll try to keep in touch with them on a daily basis, usually by voicemail or text. Sometimes the kind of wireless connections or the, you know, the internet connections aren't great. So there's periods when you don't know where they are, or you can't get hold of them. And then when they come back, we'll also kind of do a debrief with them and see how they've been, how they're feeling. Because when you come back from these, when you're there, I think a little bit of adrenaline is pumping as well. Mm-hmm. It's when you come back and you sit down and then it catches up with
right.
you. You know, what you've seen, the devastation, you know, children who've become orphans, and there's a whole host of things you're seeing when you're there on the ground, and it can impact you then, but it also impacts you when you come back. So we try to keep an eye on people, make sure they're okay. And, you know, once they get back into the normal routine of life, that you know, it becomes a little bit easier. But the Jardikala is always there. There's, you know, our community in the midst of, you know, horrible things, you know, you're still smiling, cracking the odd joke. And,
yeah.
You know, I think the Jardikala kind of comes in when you're interacting with those who you're helping, and the smiles on their faces, the kind of unconditional love you're giving them, it's reciprocated. And, you know, we've been giving out jackets to children and they've been just overwhelmed yeah. and happy and smiling. And it's, you know, the Jardikala kind of sin, for want of a better term, in the seva you're doing.
Yeah, that is... it definitely put a smile on my face to hear, to even just think of the reactions of the children and the families who are receiving this aid, and they must feel so grateful. And it's just so, just even thinking about it is such a, puts a smile on my face and puts me in a good spirit. So I could only imagine that Jardikala that comes into you once you're actually on ground seeing this happen. Yeah. Hearing of the work that is being done is so important. And I guess my final question, a very important question, would be, how can the listeners, how can we all support Khalsa Aid in turkey relief, but also just in relief in general that is being done by Khalsa Aid?
You can always go to our webpage. That'll give details if you know, on financial donations. But what's also important is share the work we're doing,
mm-hmm.
On your social media pages, retweet or reshare what we're doing, or even just give us a comment, you know, in the posts we put about, you know, how you feel and what you're seeing and how it's impacting you. I mean, those things always matter to us. The more interaction we have with the Sangat, then the more we feel kind of, you know, the Jardikala kicks in even more than for us.
Absolutely. That is beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Jindy Singh, for joining me today on the podcast. It was an amazing conversation and has definitely put me with a smile on my face and ready to just see what I can do to support Khalsa Aid. It's always been an organization very, very close to my heart, and it was an amazing opportunity to get to speak with you today. So thank you for joining us and spending some of your Sunday with me here. I hope you definitely have a great rest of your day. And again, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.